HealthIQ.com/TRN.
That is where you can get life insurance with A-rated companies for a better price. Because you're healthy, because you're a runner, because you're taking care of yourself, you're eating right, you should live longer.
And if you're alive, you need life insurance.
Health IQ is a great place to go. Go to healthiq.com/TRN. Path Projects. Don, I ran in my Path Projects kit this morning, and I've told you about how much I love the shorts because I don't have to pull them down.
Right, right.
I mean, the crotch. I don't pull them down on the trail. But I got to say, I think I'm falling in love with the shirt more than the shorts. I love the shorts, but boy, that shirt is comfortable.
You know, I didn't run today, but I still wore them. I tell you, they're just they're everyday wear stuff. I love it.
And we have Scott Bailey on the phone with us. He is the owner and founder of Path Projects. Tell us a little bit about what kind of material you're using and why this is so much better than what's out there now for runners.
Yeah, I think on the shorts, we're using a mill out of Japan called Toray. And they use materials that are called mechanical stretch. So they don't have lycra or spandex in them. So it makes for a much stronger nylon. It doesn't absorb water. It's lighter weight because the spandex actually is a heavy material. So you get a stronger, lighter, less water absorbent fabric in the shorts. And then on the shirt, we use this really great blend. It's called tinsel, which is made from eucalyptus trees. And we use that with a nylon blend, and it gives you a natural feel. And what we try and do on every material is find the best possible material to use. And most people aren't using these materials at all because they're too expensive.
You know, it's really great feeling material. It's unlike anything else.
Yeah, it's the material is it's about $8 a yard, and it's the equivalent of having like an $85 t-shirt, which most people wouldn't buy that $85 t-shirt. But in our model, it works, and we can sell it at $40.
Yeah, so going direct, you kind of cut out that middleman, and we can all wear $85 t-shirts.
We are grateful that you cut out the middleman, because I don't think I would even sample a t-shirt that cost $85. My wife would not let me.
You can't even get into the store that has an $85 t-shirt.
So yeah, you've made it available, just a quality piece of garment for an affordable price.
Yeah, I say it's like flying first class. Once you fly first class, you never want to go back to coach.
Well, thank you.
You seem to have caught lightning in a bottle here. How come everybody isn't running around with their bottles open trying to capture this?
I think that, you know, our shirt material is about almost $8 a yard, which is way more expensive for a normal athletic company to use. But because we do it consumer direct, we only mark the product up one time, so we can actually use twice as expensive materials as a normal company and sell it basically at the same price.
Well, and there is a big difference. I mean, we can tell it when you put it on that there's a difference.
It absolutely, all you need to do is try it on one time. So we highly recommend you go to pathprojects.com and get yourself stuff. Link over to from our partners page. And you can sign up for a giveaway of a free kit. That's going to include the shorts, the base liner, and the shirt and a hat. And we actually have the first winner of the drawing, and that is Joshua Sun from Davenport, Iowa. So Joshua listened to our first podcast where we talked about Path Projects. He entered, and he is now going to be a recipient of this awesome wear.
Can you continue to register for this, Scott? What's the deal? More giveaways?
Every week.
So we're going to be giving a full kit away every week. And if you registered in the first week, you'll be registered for all 5 weeks.
Oh, okay. So you don't have to re-register. That saves me time.
Yeah. You know what I like, Scott, is both Scotts. It's fun. There are two Scotts here. So I could say it once, two birds, one stone. There are hidden pockets in these things. They look sleek. They look stealth, but I find these zippers and I go, hey, there's a pocket here. You can just wear them and they don't feel clunky or anything. They're built to fit.
And they fit the big phones too, the larger phones. That's the thing I like about them. So Scott, thank you for designing and producing these great garments. I am in love. I don't leave the house without them.
Great. Thank you guys so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Boys and girls of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will the group of the nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Courtney, go ahead.
Oh, well, hey, guys. Welcome to another Trail Runner Nation episode. We're with Andy Jones Wilkins and the two masterminds behind it all.
I'm Don Freeman, and that is Scott War. And that was an introduction by Courtney DeWalter, who is joining us from lovely Colorado. Golden, Colorado.
And golden, maybe because she has a golden ticket in her hand right now. Congratulations to that, Courtney. Went out to Sean O'Brien and found your way into Western States 2018. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. Now I need any wisdom that anyone's got for me.
So I'm curious. I know you were going out there to try to get that golden ticket, but was Western States your A race for this year? Or now that you have the golden ticket and you're in Western States, do things shuffle around a little bit?
The hope for the year was to get into Western States and get to experience an amazing 100-mile race with some incredible people. So that's been the goal since, late last fall, probably. It was like starting to spin the gears and thinking about if I could make it happen or not. And I feel really lucky that I'll get to toe the line there.
Well, if we only had someone on this call that knew a little something about Western States. AJW, I think this is your turn to talk.
Hey, Courtney, I got to ask. I mean, this is this is some advanced planning for you, isn't it? I mean, you still have like 4.5 months. So, you got probably 6 or 7 races you can do between now and then.
I know, totally thrown off my game.
Hey, I just want to let everybody know, if they don't know who Courtney is, she has won the last 6 races that she has started.
Ooh.
And of those 6... she won, but of those 6, 3 of them, she won outright. And in addition to those 3, she's also outright won 7 additional races. So 10 of the races she's raced, she's been the number one person through the finish line.
You know, she's my number one every time that she's out there. I think she's a fantastic runner. I will tell the short story of Moab when she was completing the race and I had 100 miles left. I knew right there that she was something special.
You didn't take any shortcuts, did you, Courtney?
No, definitely not.
So hey, let's talk a little bit about Western States. We had a lot on our plate for today, but with respect to Western States, like, a lot of the running you've done in the last 18 months since you sort of burst on the scene has really, really shown off a great amount of versatility, you know, really great efforts on the track and in timed events and so forth. And then, you know, more recently in some of these long mountainous events like Moab and, some shorter distance stuff, you know, Western States really is a nice blending of those things. I mean, it's a very runnable course. The trail's in incredible condition. I mean, there are definitely parts of it that feels like you're running on a road. It's so smooth, you know, with some burst of vertical and some steep here. So it does play into a runner who's a runner's runner, who can run fast, but can also make a quick time on the climbs, particularly in the middle of the course. So as you've sort of evolved, especially in the last 18 months, how do you blend your training between the flat, fast stuff and the sort of steep, hilly stuff?
I mean, yeah, I could just listen to you talk about Western States for an hour if we want to and spill any of those tidbits out for me. But I think they all feed into each other. So for 24-hour racing, I don't go and do long runs on a track to train for it, even though those races are held on tracks oftentimes. But I think just like long days out on trails or roads or bike paths all help the other type of racing. So I'm going to be, looking for any advice and trying to learn a little bit more about the course, and then just hoping to show up in my best physical and mental form for the race and see what happens.
So there's several things. Well, I'm thinking of three in particular that are characteristic of Western States that I'd like to sort of just pick off. And the first one's the level of competition. You know, just a quick look, sort of back of the envelope for me. I see about 20 women that are currently in the field, and there's still a half dozen more spaces that are gonna be, presented as golden tickets. And those 20 women, would be a chance of top 5 to top 7. And it's a blend of very experienced Western States people, a couple people who've done really well in the last year or two, a couple people who haven't done Western States yet, but have great, pedigree and have had success in the last 18 months, sort of the bucket that you're in. And I know, knowing a little bit about your history, how have you performed in the sort of crucible of competition in international races? And does it have any different mental impact on you than a race where you simply, blow away the field by several hours?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the best example I have so far is the World Championships for the 24-hour race. Yeah. Which did not go well for me. So I will be trying to not have that one in the forefront of my mind. And I have so much respect for, everyone towing the line at a 100-mile race, but the women's field at Western States is some people that I think are like the most amazing athletes. And I will be looking to them for kind of watching their examples, see how to do it.
And that's really one of the most fun things about the race from my experience there, is that it really is, it's a competitive crucible for sure, but everybody's there sort of with and for each other. Okay. So the next item, how do you do in the heat? I mean, there's no denying the fact that Western States always brings the heat. I mean, even in a benign year, it's going to be 90 degrees, and in the real intense years, it's going to be 110, 115.
Yeah. I'm going to knock on wood, so far have done okay in the heat, but this will be a whole different animal. And we'll be going into it with that definitely, as something like a factor to keep in mind in the training, and then just on race day. Like, that's a variable that I've got to handle like everyone else out there.
So then my last one, and then I'll let these guys start talking.
But no, this because, is good, AJW.
So, the big three, there's sort of the big three of Western States success, the being able to handle the crucible of competition, knowing your way around heat, and whether you've had success in the heat or not, but training for the heat and knowing that it's going to be hot. And, right. and then the third one is course knowledge. And you're not going to have the same course knowledge that Megan Laws has. She lives in Cool and so on and so forth. But have you thought at all about making a trip out there to get to know the course a little bit, maybe in April or May?
Yeah, I think it would be really cool. I haven't firmed anything up yet, but I'm aware that would be definitely an advantage to see some of those sections.
Yeah, I mean, you are such a like free flow runner, and which is awesome. And I guess if in the interest of advice, you can still free flow Western States, knowing a little bit about the course, particularly when the three things converge. There's five women within 5 minutes of one another. It's 110 degrees, and the four of them actually know what's coming up, and I don't. That can be the kind of thing something that, that can wear on you mentally. Whereas if you can say, oh yeah, I remember when we did this back in May when I did the training run with blah, blah, blah. And boy, now I know what's coming, and so I'm not afraid of it. So,
do you ever think that ignorance is bliss in those kinds of things?
I do, and but it reminds me of Matt Carpenter with Leadville, where he ran it in 2004. His quads were trashed. He ended up walking it in. And he decided at that point that he didn't want to see the course at all between 2005 and when he got to the race in 2010, because he wanted it to be fresh. He wanted it to be. And so certainly that's the kind of thing, depending on your personality or temperament, that you might want to ask yourself. Because, yeah, absolutely, there's something so exciting where it's like, oh, so this is Michigan Bluff.
Right,
this is
what they mean.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, and there are absolutely examples of people who've gone to Western States and done well sight unseen. There's no doubt about that. So it rewards, most of all, it rewards patience and coming there with the right attitude and, making the day as fun as it can be.
Yeah. Well, I might be emailing you with any questions that I might have. I know you're quite experienced on the course.
Well, I've never had a conversation about Western States that I didn't enjoy.
and he knows every inch of that course, from a spreadsheet to actually being on the course
on his knees at times. Even hey, now Courtney, you might notice that the level of questions might drop off here a bit. Do you have a dog?
No, go ahead, Scott.
I do not have a dog.
Okay.
No animals.
Go ahead.
I'll explain the joke to you later, Scott. I'll draw a picture.
Okay. I need a picture.
It was our line, level of questioning is not quite as good as AJW's. Go ahead.
One of the things, this is actually a take two of the podcast we started a couple weeks ago. And one of the things that came up that I think it would be very interesting to dig into a little bit is how, Courtney, you train. I think it's very unique for this day and age where we have all these gadgets that can track us, Strava, training plans, and all that sort of stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about how, let's take this for example.
Western States,
how are you going to train for Western States? Do you have spreadsheets wallpapering your kitchen? Or how are you going to do it?
No, I just have a dartboard that has different workouts listed on it. I just throw a dart at the board every day and see.
I like that.
It seems to be working out.
I need to get a dartboard.
No, I don't follow a training plan. I follow a no-plan plan where every day I just listen to my body and that determines what kind of miles I do or what sort of pace I do or hills or no hills. So oftentimes when I leave my house, I don't even know where I'm going and just sort of let my feet and my legs and my brain decide based on how tired or how fresh each of those things feels.
That reminds me a lot of Brad Kearns, who we've had on here before, who is a well-known triathlete in our area, an experienced endurance athlete, has his own podcast too. And he speaks about intuitive training, of just going out there and doing exactly what you said, Courtney, of giving yourself permission to decrease your intensity, increase it, and respond to how you feel. And I think that is just a brilliant strategy.
You know,
I grew up having some really incredible coaches, so I'm not like totally in the dark on what workouts can look like and things like that. So I think having grown up with such amazing people teaching me how to train, it's kind of built it into me a little bit.
I want to get back to the intuitive listening to your body. I mean, when do you listen to your body? Before you leave the house? I mean, you're lacing up your shoes and you're going, you know, today I feel pretty good. I had a good breakfast. I'm going to go out and run 20 miles. I think that if I was to train intuitively, I would never leave home. I would think, you know, I just don't feel like it. I just don't want to do it. Because sometimes you have to push beyond what you're feeling and go extend yourself a little bit further?
That's a great question. I want to hear Courtney, and I want to hear Coach AJW give us his input on that too. So both of you, intuitive training, please.
Yeah, I mean, one of the centerpieces of my training is consistency and getting out the door every day and not making excuses. So I do try and get out the door, lace them up every day, and not fall into a habit of making excuses that make it okay to slough off or whatever. But once I'm out the door, then I'll totally tune in on like, ooh, this does not feel good today, or I just need to go for a walk around the block instead. Or yeah, I feel great. Let's get 20 miles in.
AJW, what about intuitive training?
I try to adhere to the 10-minute rule and urge some of the folks I work with to do that. And don't make any decision about how good or bad you feel until you've been, you know, moving along, whether it's a trail or the road, for 10 minutes. So, you know, what a lot of people, you know, might just have a particular loop they like to do out of their house, you know, in the morning, and they know when they get to, you know, a mailbox that's about 10 minutes away, they can make the decision, you know, am I going to do a little bit up tempo today? Am I going to tack on a couple extra miles around that little mountain over there? Or is this going to be one of those days where I bring it back? I don't know if there's a lot of science behind the 10-minute rule, but it does seem to work that, you know, and if you decide, oh my gosh, I feel great 2 minutes into the workout, and you start pushing too hard, you know, you could derail what could be a good energetic workout. And certainly if you feel lousy in the first 2-3 minutes and you just call it quits and walk back, you might miss an opportunity to take a bad start and turn it into a, you know, and ultimately a good run. The caveat to the 10-minute rule, of course, is if you're fighting some sort of injury. You know, if you're coming out the door and you feel something that's clearly, you know, making you limp or something like that, then don't suck it up for 10 minutes because you could be causing more damage. But that's a general thing that's intuitive. I also think one of the nice things about intuitive training, particularly if you, like Courtney suggested, if you value consistency, is you can find yourself, you know, running the same routes over and over and over again. And part of what makes, you know, the best runners so good is that the mind-numbing repetition of training is actually liberating and not necessarily mind-numbing. And when you capitalize on that, then it just feeds on itself.
So a question to you both, because you're in a position to answer, is how do you give yourself permission to pull back without feeling guilty or undertrained or not living up to your own personal expectations? How do you manage that? Or do you? Does that make sense? Was that a question?
Yeah, I mean, I think because I don't know what I'm doing every day, I don't feel married to any specific workout. So I don't ever feel like I was supposed to do 15 miles today. I didn't do 15 miles. Now I feel guilty.
Right.
It's just totally, I was tired. I'm taking some time now, and we'll reassess tomorrow and see how I feel. So just a fresh start every day when there's no plan that you're following.
I think that's good.
And I think giving yourself permission to settle back or cut things short is also something that comes from experience. That, like, you know, if you do that a couple of times and you realize that you're not just doing that, it's not going to just make you fat and out of shape, you know,
right.
That it's like, okay, you know, I've learned, I listened to my body. I turned my 45-minute run into a 20-minute run. And then guess what? I'm going to be fresh and nice tomorrow. And it'll be great.
Good mindset.
What about the technology and all the software out there? I mean, do you subscribe to that? I mean, do you go out there and are you looking at your heart rate monitor or your pace and making decisions on that? Or is it completely an internal feeling?
Mine is totally internal. I now wear a Suunto watch, but I trained with my Timex start and stop button watch for, I mean, 28 years. So mostly I start it and I stop it, but during I don't look at it or care about the pace or any of the pieces necessarily. But it's been a new development then to have like a record of the mileage that I've been doing to hopefully maybe use it to improve or just be able to reflect back if things start going off track a little bit.
Begs another question. Do you, before you had the Sun 2 watch and you were just using the Timex, were you measuring or counting or recording mileage or vertical? Or was it just only time?
Just time.
Time and effort.
Hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That is what AJW calls old school.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all they had back then was little stopwatches.
So,
right?
So take us back to some old school stuff, AJW. When you say old school, what are you referencing? And let's see if it matches up with Courtney.
Well, what we've been hitting on for a little while, intuitive training, going on what you feel versus what the computer spits back at you. Another thing that I would mention related to that is, you know, taking in the course of a race, taking what the day gives you. So you could be 6 hours in and, you know, it's a nice, downhill rolling part and you're feeling good. Go for it a little, stretch out the legs. The year Hal Koerner won, Hard Rock, he really did that. He got to, you know, the long descent going down into Ouray and just realized he was feeling good. And next thing you know, he was clicking off 6:30 miles and, you know, he passed a bunch of people and ended up in the lead. And that was, it was early in the race, you know, by Hard Rock standards, it was about mile 40. And he just capitalized on that and was feeling good. So I think that, you know, and maybe he was feeling bad later. And in the course of a 100-mile race, you're going to have your bad patches. And the point is, if you have a good patch, you might as well make the most of that good patch, provided you don't, you know, overcook yourself and do something really stupid. So there's a fair amount of experience. You know, having that old school attitude does require a fair amount of experience. I would say another key part of old school is keeping all your gear and nutrition and crap just to absolute minimum. I mean, you know, some of the drop bags I see at aid stations that are like the size of they wouldn't even fit in an overhead compartment of an airplane. I mean, you know, people put this stuff in drop bags and then they open up the drop bag and they take out a gel. And then, you know,
what if we needed a blender?
Right.
You never know.
You might need a blender and a generator to run that blender. I mean, there's no stopping this. Hey, you know, I can't remember who we had on the podcast. This was probably years ago. Elite runner, and they said that when they start a race, they go out full on, 100% full pace, and just see if they can hang on. And that tells them whether they're having a good day. If they can hang on, you know, keep that pace and you know, that real fast pace for the first 10 miles, then they know that it's a good day, versus starting out at a very conservative pace and just kind of building that into a crescendo in the middle of the race and the finish. What is your philosophy on that?
You want to go for that, AJW?
Well, I mean, I think there's some old school guys that have laid waste to that first theory. Eric Clifton comes to mind, who I think is probably still the course record holder for the Western States 8K. I think the year he set that, he was decorating the high country with his puke about an hour or so later. I think as races have sped up and there's pack running now, I mean, there's certainly people who will run hard from the gun. You know, more recent runners like Zach Miller come to mind, you know, Camille Herron comes to mind, and some people will go for it and hope the wheels stay on, and others, and sometimes they stay on and sometimes they don't. I think it's an interesting style of racing. Walmsley has been kind of accused of doing that from time to time. You know, I think if you're looking for a long career in the sport, or you know, trying to be a little bit more measured, you can look at people like Megan Laws, and the way Cat Bradley ran Western States last year, Jeff Browning, that style of running, Andrew Miller a couple years ago when he won, Ryan Sands last year when he won Western States. I think you see more people have success, Scotty, in that second type of style than the first.
And hey, what's your style, Courtney?
Win by 10 hours?
No, I don't know if I have a style. But I know if someone like Camille goes off the line hard, I just don't have the leg speed to even be there with her. So I think I started a little slower, and then I just go by feel. And when it feels good, crank it out a little bit harder. And then when it's in one of those low points, to just problem solve and figure out how to get back to feeling good again.
Well, it's going to be a fun year to watch, no doubt. Do you feel that, what is your strength? Let me ask this question. I've got a question somewhere in here. If I stutter long enough, one will formulate.
once you hear a question mark, go ahead, Courtney, go ahead and start answering.
Yeah, because I won't recognize it. I'm hoping that you do. As you come into the race, what's the one thing you're most concerned about as you look at Western States? So AGW talked about high country and hills and flats and heat and all kinds of things that are unique to this race, and all races have some unique factors. Mm-hmm. What's the piece that you're concerned about or looking forward to? Both sides. Things that you like and things that you're worried about.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to take part in it and to try and put together my very best day out there and see where that lands me. And I think one of the parts I like about 100 miles is that nothing's guaranteed at the start line, and you don't know what sort of wrench will be thrown in your day, or multiple wrenches, you know? And so the problem solving piece and overcoming those obstacles as they happen is, I think, one of the cool parts.
You'll recall, AJW, from the conversation we had with Ann Trayson about the great ultra runners are great problem solvers.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that's really what Courtney's speaking to. She likes it when she has to get it in her toolkit and find the right wrench.
Well, yeah, and you know, I'm biased on this because I've spent a 27-year career in education, but I do believe, and Courtney's, I'm not going to say a retired teacher, she's just taking a break from teaching.
Just taking a break.
But I do, and please, I'm going to hold you to that, you know, and maybe even hire you someday, so... but, you know, we've got, of course, a now semi-retired teacher won Western States last year. So it's a good thing, necessarily. Educators, I believe, make good problem solvers, Don, to get to your point. Yeah. When you think about it, right, Courtney's, you know, was a middle school science teacher. Sometimes you go home and you're grading papers or labs or something, and you're like, what's the deal with this kid? What is this kid thinking? How can I get through to this kid? How can I, you know, how can I understand this student better? And sometimes you talk to other teachers about how the kid's doing. Sometimes you talk to their parents. Sometimes you talk to the kid himself and try to do some troubleshooting of that. Well, guess what? That's what you do in running also, right? You sometimes you talk to the elders in the sport who've done it before. Sometimes you speak with your fellow competitors. Sometimes you speak to people who know the course really well. You know, and you take that accumulated knowledge, because at the end of the day, most teachers are lifelong learners. I mean, I'd like to think we're all lifelong learners, but people who have chosen that for their field. So I do think, while there's all kinds of people who run ultras, I think the best people who run ultras are teachers. So there you have it.
You know, Andy, I never thought of that. My daughter is a fifth grade teacher. And she's, well, of course, I'm biased, but she's a pretty darn good one. And I mm-hmm. think that she's good at it because she got great grades, but she wasn't a great student. Mm-hmm. She had to figure out how to learn things. And to your point, I think she makes a great teacher because she realizes that not all students learn the same. And so she has to recognize and problem solve to figure out, okay, I'm getting to these three over here, but this one over here isn't quite getting it. how can I reach that person? I never thought about that. That's really interesting.
Well, and you think about it in the context of ultra running, particularly when you get past 50 miles, so much of what you have to do is deal with uncharted territory. Even if you've run 3,500 milers before, they all aren't exactly the same, especially when you get to that point that, you know, the exhaustion really sets in. So I think having that bag of tricks, in your back pocket is a benefit. And I'm sure it'll be a benefit for Courtney out at Western States.
We often talk about how ultra running sets the stage for life and it helps us integrate in life's problems better. I imagine that practicing our problem-solving skills on the trail translates mm-hmm. well to sales or teaching or, you know, whatever you happen to be doing. I think trail running not only keeps us healthy but mentally engaged and in training as well. So I think that's a good aspect of our sport. Since we're all trail runners listening to this, there's probably not a lot objecting to it.
And, you know, I have another question that I've been dying to ask. It's a little bit different. Do you mind if we
No.
move on a little bit? So we have Andy Jones-Wilkins, who is a student of the sport. He probably has more statistics on the tip of his tongue than Al Michaels, who in the anyway. I want to know, Courtney, you've outright won 10 of the races, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've outright won 10 races. Are there very many women out there, AJW, that have done that sort of thing? That's the first question. Then to you, Courtney, is what is your frame of mind going into these races? I mean, do you have a goal of beating everyone? Is that a motivator for you?
Do you have a third question you can pile on with
I'll think of one okay. by the time Andy
all right
talks.
Well, Courtney, why don't we go in reverse? Like Courtney, why don't you answer that part first, the mindset of
I am a very competitive person, mostly with myself, to try and finish a race not wondering what if or wishing a part had been more efficient or gone a little bit better. So just trying to string together miles that are as strong as I can do, whatever that looks like for that section. And when I'm thinking of like the people on the course, I don't really care if it's a male or a female. I'm going to be trying to catch them because that helps me keep being more efficient and keep stringing together solid miles. So I grew up with two brothers and was always competing with them. So it makes no difference to me if it's male or female.
Could you beat your brothers in a race, in a foot race? That's what I want to know.
Today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or back then.
Well, I think today I would put my money on you, Courtney. But back then.
Oh, I mean, our cross-country coach put us – like it was the boys and the girls teams trained together.
Yeah.
So I was in like the same pacing group as one of my brothers and we were pretty similar.
Cool.
Scotty, from the history standpoint, I mean, the Anne Trason immediately yeah. comes to mind. I mean, for probably a decade, she was definitely running Western States and Leadville with attempting to win the whole thing. I mean, it was and she was open about that. She, you know, ran her own race every time, but she finished second overall, you know, three times. And so there's she would have to be, you know, the gold standard for female runners, you know, giving male runners a run for their money. A piece I'm going to write next month in I Run Far, though, is about another woman who has been the closest since Anne Trason to outright winning Western States, and that's Nikki Kimball, who's, you know, still around. She ran Western States 10 times, all of them in the top 10, and in 2006, she was third overall. You know, only Graham Cooper and Eric Skadden finished ahead of her. And that was an incredible race. I've actually spoken with her about this because it was also the year that experienced one of the most brutal conditions, particularly in terms of heat. There was actually some humidity down in the canyons. It was a very, very challenging year with only a 54% finishers rate. And she, as well as some other folks I've talked to, Megan Laws, Beverly Anderson Abbs, do feel that women, when the going gets tough, tend to respond, whether for whatever reason. And again, I don't have any scientific basis to this, but if you looked at percentage of people dropping out of races in particularly challenging years, whether it's at Western States or other races, women, the percentage of women who drop out under adverse conditions is lower than the percentage of men that drop out. So one would then extrapolate from that, that, you know, the harder the race, the closer the women are going to be to the front. You know, Diana Finkel had a run like that at Hard Rock for a few years, where she was second, third overall, you know, and, you know, she banged herself up pretty good a couple of times. But she was out there, you know, to race everybody as well. So I think it's interesting and an amazing phenomenon that, you know, there's some studies that are circulating around now that, you know, women are the gap between men and women will get smaller the longer the distance is. So whether it's 200 miles, whether it's, you know, a 6-day race or things like that, you know, and as we gather enough data on those things, you know, we may be able to extrapolate on those. In a perfect day at Western States, you know, the men's winner is going to be, you know, the course record's 14:40. So perfect day will be around there. And the women's course record is, which was run on a perfect day, was 16:47. So like right now they're 2 hours apart. I could see them actually getting closer. You know, it'll take a good day. It'll take people like Courtney and Camille and the other 20 that are racing this year to kind of push each other to that. But I could see it happening for sure. And it's a, you know, it's an exciting time for women in the sport. I think on the flip side of the coin, we do have an issue with participation and with women just because of the nature of some of these lotteries and so on and so forth, that the participation numbers in the big ticket hundreds at least are unusually low. Not in Western States, but in the others. So it's an issue to tackle probably in another time, but something that I think the fast women of today are likely to inspire a new generation of women into the sport, perhaps even at a younger age and at a more competitive level.
It makes me think about the 4-minute mile. You know, once it was once it was crossed, now all of a sudden everybody's doing it, or many more people are doing it. And it may be the same thing with the permission to, you know, close that gap and to take the top position on the podium, that it's being done. It's possible to be done. We know it can be done now. It's not something that's etched in stone. Doesn't matter which gender you are, just get out there and run hard.
Well, and I get the impression that when Courtney finally does it, she's not going to be surprised.
Oh, either will we.
Hey, Courtney, you mentioned earlier about efficiency. I want to get in your mind here a minute. Let's say you're out on the course and you're racing. Are you thinking primarily about your efficiency, processing food, pace, gait, or are you primarily thinking about how can I go faster? Which is a priority?
I think they're kind of the same. And I do think of efficiency out on the course and section by section, just trying to stay in that mindset of like, do this section as efficient as you can right now. So if it's like a sandy section, there's no point in like getting your pants in a bunch about the sand. Like everyone's got that, you know? So just trying to move through it with as little mental struggle and physical struggle as I can is what I keep in mind. And I think that then ties in directly with like just continuing to try and go quickly through stuff.
Do you detach yourself, or do you try to get in a zone where you're not thinking about things, or are you always checking the Don Freeman gauges that he talks about, all the gauges of pace and food and all that sort of stuff?
No, I definitely do miles where I'm not thinking of the race or of what is happening in that exact moment and let my mind wander, or just try and turn it off for a little and go radio silence for a bit.
How many miles into the race do you know that this is my day? And we're going to take the 100-mile race. At some point you go, yep, everything's clicking. I just got to boogie down this thing and get to the finish line. Is there a spot in the race?
Yeah, at the finish line.
Good answer. All right. How about you, AJW? Is there a spot in the race where you go, you know what, this day is working out. You know, that burrito I had is just fine. I got enough sleep. Everything's good.
Yeah, it usually would happen to me more in hours than miles. I'd get like the 10-hour mark for whatever. You know, if I was running, say, to run a 17 or 18 hour 100, if I made it past the 10-hour mark and the systems were working and everything seemed to be holding together, I knew it was going to be a good day.
Hmm. Can you relate an example of when something where the wheels fell off the bus and it might have even caught you off guard? Sometimes you know the wheels are going to fall off or you're anticipating that, but sometimes you're not even thinking about it. Can you relate an experience where the wheels fell off the bus and you really had to work to get back on track?
You want to start, AJW?
No, you start. Although, have your wheels not fallen off yet?
They absolutely have.
And, okay.
Usually I can scramble after them and regroup and keep going. I would say the like most surprising wheel fall off happened at the World Championships for 24 hours, where I wasn't even paying attention. And I think that was kind of my demise, but I was attached to a pace and I was going to hold it no matter what. And the wheels came off and I mean, I couldn't find them after that. And it was such a surprise because it was like holding this pace and not feeling great. But I mean, who is at that point? And then at like 16 hours, they fell off entirely. And then it was just walking for the last 8 hours of the race, trying to keep moving. So I've definitely had them fall off. And I mean, there's always, you can always reflect back and think through what happened, but sometimes it's like hard to explain or associate with a specific thing.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn from that specifically? What would you have done different? What early clues did you, looking back, have that if you would have corrected and just tweaked at that moment, that you never would have had any problems with the wheels? Was there something?
Yeah.
Was there something early?
I think I got just caught up in the whole thing, the whole event, the pace, trying to like go for it right from the beginning because I was so jazzed on wearing this USA uniform. Yeah. and I wasn't doing my race and wasn't listening to myself and nutrition wasn't going in like it should. And I mean, in hindsight, I should have just reset the system, slowed my roll for a couple hours and then tried to regroup and go again. But I was not wanting to slow down at all.
And sometimes we learn more from failure or from mismanagement than if everything rolled out perfect, you know, maybe you wouldn't have learned anything. But now you can bring that experience to every single race you come across and make early adjustments, early tweaks, and problems solved before they become problems.
Yeah, exactly.
AJW, have you had your wheels fall off?
Yeah, a bunch of times, but the worst one was at Wasatch. I think it was 2009. I was maybe eight. I ran the first half really great, really well, and got into Lambs Canyon feeling good. And I was actually running with Jeff Rose. We were kind of running stride for stride, and I thought, okay, this is going to be a race. There were a couple other guys with us, and he opened a little bit of a lead between mile 60 and mile 75. But I got to the mile 75 aid station, and they told me he was only 6 minutes ahead, and I knew it was a big, huge climb. So I was like, well, let's just – Craig Thornley was pacing me at the time. Let's just put our heads down and get this done. And I hammered the uphill trying to catch him, and it was a really, really stupid mistake because I trashed everything and had to stumble down the descent, got to the aid station, and they told me he was like half an hour ahead. And it was just so demoralizing, and yet I didn't realize I didn't do any sort of regrouping. I just kept trying to push through and push through and push through.
Ooh, interesting.
And we got to mile about 88, and Craig's behind me, and he's like, you know, I think you can probably just walk as fast as you're running right now. and possibly on the uphills even faster. And I was like, all right, well, let's just keep moving along. Let's keep moving along with, you know, let's get to mile 93 and see what kind of gap we Jeff has at that point. And so we rolled into mile 93. Craig goes over to the guy to find out the gap, and I'm like eating some food or whatever. And I was like, so, and he's like, you don't want to know. at which point I just sat down in a chair and took out a burrito or something. So the only way I was going to have the wheels put back on at that point was to slow the wheels down, which I did.
Hey, Courtney, do you want to know that gap, that information that's out there? Would you rather run oblivious or have people giving you information, realizing that sometimes aid station information always isn't the most accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's helpful. And just knowing that sometimes it's a little bit off, so not being attached to any of the numbers that get thrown at you, and just like taking it as one little tidbit of information, and it's not going to like make or break my race either way, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Courtney, are you always smiling? I'm having a tough time seeing you go through a bad spot in my head
she
on
smiles,
the trail.
Smiles during the bad
she
spot.
Smiles during the bad spot.
No, I'm not always smiling.
I know it makes me smile just looking at you. So thank you.
Oh, thank you,
Courtney. What have you thought through your sort of tune up your schedule, your spring schedule going in? I mean, we know, of course, what you're going to be doing June 23rd, but did you have any races, for example, you'd previously been committed to that you're going to do? Any traveling to Europe or faraway places in the lead up to Western States?
I'm still kind of figuring out some of the last details, but I like to race, and so mm-hmm. I will definitely be trying to fit in probably one a month between now and June, just as like clean off the gears, you know, flush out the pipes and make sure everything is good to go for June.
It sounds good. Are you able to run a race like with your mindset of it being a training race, or when we've talked about this on the podcast a lot, when you put a bib on, it's a race?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not great at slow rolling intentionally, but I think that it is good training to go harder and push your body every once in a while in one of those races. So when I put on a bib, I'm racing usually, and I think that's okay for now.
And are you able to recover pretty quickly?
Pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting a little better at it.
How do you handle the question or the comment with a runner next to you going, oh, I shouldn't be up here? How do you internally manage that kind of expectation or just their comments? Do you let it affect your race at all?
I guess I can't think of a recent scenario where that occurred. Mostly they're like, how do you run in those shorts?
Obvious. So tell us about your shorts.
We need to get to that question too.
What about those shorts? If you haven't
like,
seen a photo
oh,
of
the shorts.
If you haven't seen a photo of Courtney, she wears like basketball shorts. Yeah.
Real long basketball shorts. What's up with that?
I mean, the ones I'm racing in, those are my short shorts.
You have longer ones at home, huh?
You should see my actual basketball shorts.
Courtney, you'll appreciate this because I'm a school principal, and the shorts that the teenage girls wear to school are short shorts. And and their moms call and they say, Andy, can you please tell my daughter to put some more clothes on? So the fact that those are your short shorts, let's hope that rubs off on the youth of today.
Let's start a new trend. Hashtag Courtney shorts.
Where does that come from? Is that just the type of clothing you've always enjoyed wearing?
Yeah. I'm totally comfortable, and I think comfort is the number one priority with your gear. So,
good. Did you play basketball?
Not well.
Hey, so are you going to carry bottles or a hydration pack? Old school, it was bottles only. We carried bottles back in the day, and then everybody seems to have a hydration pack on. And you can chime in on that. But what is your fluid of choice, delivery system?
Yeah, I really am liking the vests that have the bottles in the front, because I like my hands to be free to fidget with things or to open food and stuff like that. And I feel a little restricted with bottles in my hands when I'm trying to do those things. No. But I haven't thought through all the details of it yet. It's still many months out.
Yeah, remember, for Courtney, this is like eternity.
Yeah. Well, now, AJW, back in old school days, we hear stories from Dana Gard and some of those guys that they carried mustard bottles around even before the nice handhelds. They were using syrup bottles
from Jemima syrup
everything.
Bottles.
And then they moved, what I would witness is the two bottles in that pack that they'd carry behind their back. You know, they have those two bottles
fanny
back
pack.
There, a fanny pack with bottles, then bottles only, then hydration pack. That seems to be the evolution of fluid delivery system. Any thoughts on that? Any comments?
Well, I'm still a handheld guy, but I've started to realize it's kind of like when they discontinue a shoe that you like. I think I'm going to have to stock up on handhelds before they stop making them.
I've got plenty.
it was funny. I was, you know, Brian Powell and I were going back and forth last night because I wrote this article about the 1999 Angeles Crest 100, which was a great showdown between Tom Nielsen and Scott Jurek and Ian Torrance, and you know all
great
the pictures.
Article.
Yeah, all the pictures.
Article.
All the pictures had the guys with handhelds, you know, and they were and Powell was joking like, man, it's they all look like you with the handhelds, you know, so. you know, I do think the packs that are now vests that almost fit like, like a shirt, and you can almost not feel them and they don't bump. I mean, I do think that they have their advantage. I think those of us who still use handhelds probably mostly do it just sort of because it's a habit and something we like to do. But, you know, for me going into Hard Rock, you know, and the using poles, which is a big part of the race, particularly in the second half, you can't use handhelds because you got poles. So, you know, you have to find a pack that works ultimately.
Hmm. Have you tried poles, Courtney?
In Moab, I used them for a little bit, like the last, maybe, probably last 20 miles I had them out, and some of the different climbs I had them. Grew up Nordic skiing, so we did a lot of like pole hiking, pole bounding, stuff like that.
Don and I've argued about that a little bit, about the V2. Is that what it's called? V2?
Yeah, V2 and
V2. V1.
Yeah. I keep on telling him, I said, Don, you're using these wrong. You got to go V2 when you're going up the hill. And he's looking at me going, you're stupid.
Oh, no.
That's not what I said.
It's very true. And depending on how steep the descent is. I mean, you guys watch in the Olympics this week, you know, you'll see him go into the V2 and the V2 alternate on the steep climbs. And I really do think you can translate that into running, but you know, not in a race as you know, mundane as Western States. You got to have some real steep stuff to actually get a benefit out of those.
And Scott, I may have said you're stupid, but it wasn't referring
it wasn't,
to the poles.
It was a general comment.
It wasn't about the poles. Let's keep the story straight.
Well, there's a whole list of there's a punch list of things we could put out.
Well, let's save that for another podcast.
It may be a part three podcast.
Well, that's good. So in parting here, AJW, a piece of golden advice, a golden nugget, some wisdom that you could pass along to Courtney.
Oh,
who's
man.
Very, yeah.
Let me get out my notebook.
She actually is. What do you have, AJW?
As much as the competition is there and all of that, I mean, number one piece of advice is savor the fact that now you're in the big dance. You've got 5 months to go. The buildup is as much of a part of it as the actual event, maybe even more. But at the same time, as you're savoring it and you're at the top of the sport right now, you know, it's not going to be there forever. So, you know, someday, whether it's 15 or 30 years from now, if you wanted to do it, you'd have to apply like everyone else through the lottery. And so the fact that you're in it and you're in this incredible time in your running career, take advantage of it. Sort of the meta version of, if you're feeling good, Hal Kerner at Hard Rock, if you're feeling good, go for it. And then the other thing, which is sort of counter, is don't change anything. You know, don't all of a sudden train like according to a program, because you don't train according to a program and it's work. Don't all of a sudden test out some new nutrition plan or new shoes or new, because even though it is an eternity for you, it's actually a relatively short period of time. And then whatever you do, however you work out your race strategy, set it up so that when you are crossing the river at mile 78 and you're going up that climb, you are ready to run and run the last 20 miles where you virtually will run every step. I mean, because Courtney, if you went out and ran that last 20 miles just as a regular old training run, you'd probably do it in 3 hours and 20 minutes or 3.5 hours. I mean, it is a runnable, smooth, awesome section of trail. And you want to be feeling good enough when you cross that river, no matter what place you're in, that you can finish that race on a high, because, you know, getting to that track on fumes is not very much fun. But getting to that track knowing that you've put it all in and put the race together, that would be that. Then it's a, whatever place you're in, it's a victory.
I love it. Thank you. So there you go. That's all super helpful, and you're a wealth of knowledge, sir.
Yeah, he is very good at that, and I feel like I'm on the Courtney train right now. And there's a lot of us that have jumped on and enjoying the ride with you. So,
and I just through Andy talking about that section, I'm thinking tomorrow I want to go up and run that section from Cool down to the to No Hands Bridge. That's one of my favorite pieces of the course.
It's a great course, and I think I want to go apply to get into Western States. He just makes me want to run. Is there any golden tickets left, HOW?
I don't even work for the race. I just they get free marketing out of me. What can I say?
So Courtney, you have next weekend you're running the Black Canyon Ultra 100K, right?
Yeah. Yep. That was going to be my go for a golden ticket as well, in case things didn't go well.
So you have that and
she's going to collect all the golden tickets, so it eliminates her competition.
You only need one. Courtney, you only need one. They don't take any time off if you have three. There's no kind of a handicap there. Well, wish you luck.
The nice thing about Black Canyon is you may get a little bit of heat, you know, in the mid 80s or so, and Jamil's designed it to be a net downhill, so
yeah.
You get some nice downhill, especially in that first 30 miles. So it should be fun.
Yeah, I'm excited to go down there. They put on great events, so
yeah,
it'll be cool no matter what. We'll see how my legs feel.
Well, that's great. We've appreciated you on this podcast. We will remind people that you were on a podcast last fall after we talked about Moab 240.
Mm-hmm.
We'll link that on the podcast notes, which everybody reads. and we wish you the best of luck. Go out and run.
Moss. Hey, Courtney.
Thanks, you guys. Thank you so much.
So much better than last time. We didn't have a galloping horse. The volumes were just right, and it was exciting.
We had our brains in our heads.
Yeah, yeah. Scott, you seemed actually prepared today.
What? AJW, your comments are just so good. Courtney, isn't he just a fantastic wealth of information?
Oh, fantastic. Hey, what's going to be the name of your podcast?
No, he's going to get this one day. Yeah. We're just going to hand it over to Mr. Wilkins.
All that technology stuff on the desk there. I have no idea how any of that
works. It's all for show. We're just using our headphones.
These are props. They're empty. They're not.
It's like the X-ray machine. It doesn't do anything.
You do know they're recording out of a chiropractor studio. I mean, that's...
Hey, Courtney, if you do decide to get out here for one of the training weekends, let us know. We'd love to sit down and have you come sit down in the chiropractor's office and do a live recording.
Yeah, or we can just go grab a beer or something.
And if you need a place to stay, you have places, I'm sure, but you're welcome if you need a crash place, and that's absolutely free. So you're welcome to.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. We're going to do this 2 weeks.
What? This? You know, well, I get excited. I want to release right away. Every time I do a podcast, I'm like, that's the best one ever. We want to release it right now.
No. You guys really try and get this out soon.
Okay.
Who's the one that we... what did we do yesterday?
Yeah, we don't remember yesterday, so we might as well do this today.
Did you do Kressler?
Oh, yeah. That was so good.
Yeah, don't wait on this. I mean, because, Courtney's going to go out now and win Black Canyon, and this will be old news.
Okay, we'll do that this week then.
Okay.
All right. You sold us, AJW.
Hey, have a nice weekend, everybody. See you guys.
Yeah, right. You too.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Right. Take care.